Well, we're considering that rather long passage this evening, Mark chapter 7, verses 31 to chapter 8, verse 26. Stonehenge was built with a purpose. Those 5-ton standing stones were dragged 150 miles out of Wales and into Wiltshire. So it wasn't constructed on a whim. Those stones were carefully aligned with the sunrise of the summer solstice and the sunset of the winter solstice. So something sophisticated was going on. And yet, still nobody really knows what was the purpose behind the construction of Stonehenge. And I have to be honest, I felt a similar way about the passage we've just read. Clearly, this text has been carefully and purposefully constructed. Mark describes his feeding of the 4,000 in a way which is so similar to the feeding of the 5,000, it can't be accidental. Mark describes this healing of the deaf man in chapter 7, 31 to 37, in a way which carefully reflects the healing of the blind man in chapter 8, verses 22 to 26. So there are clear indications of design, of purpose. But what exactly is that purpose? And I, for one, have found it quite difficult to answer that question in a way which does justice to Mark's epic craftsmanship. But at the same time, the scriptures invite us to grapple with them. We're supposed to struggle towards an understanding. And while I can't claim to have fully comprehended this passage, nevertheless, I have struggled, I have grappled with it. And it's in that spirit, then, that I want us to proceed this evening. And I want to begin by suggesting that in this passage, we find two forms of religion. Two forms of religion. Religion number one, true religion. Apparently unimpressive, yet substantial. Apparently unimpressive, yet substantial. Let's consider this feeding of the 4,000 to begin with. Now, unlike the feeding of the 5,000, which probably involved a Jewish crowd, this feeding seems to take place in the region of Decapolis. You see that in verse 31. And so probably involved a Gentile crowd. Now, as we said a few weeks ago, we've looked at how Jesus is, it seems, at the moment, embarking on this sort of mini mission to the Gentiles. We saw that reference in verse chapter 7, verse 27, to the children's bread being thrown to the dogs. And I think that's what we are now seeing. We are seeing the bread which belongs to Israel, the crumbs coming pouring down and being enjoyed by the Gentiles. So Jews and Gentiles, that's the main difference between these two feedings. But this evening, it's not so much the difference that I want to focus upon, but rather the similarity between the two feedings, the 5,000 and the 4,000. Both stories are told in a very similar way. Jesus sees the crowd. He has compassion on the crowd. The disciples ask Jesus how he will feed the crowd. Jesus asks the disciples how much food they have. They only have a little bit of bread, a little bit of fish. He then directs the crowd to sit down on the grass. He gives thanks for the food, and he gets the disciples to then feed the people. And the people go away satisfied. And among all of that similarity, I want to notice one general overarching similarity between these two feedings. And the similarity which I'm talking about is the apparent unimpressiveness of these two feedings. Like the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000 isn't dramatic. It's not an exciting event. And it's in the middle of a book which is filled with dramatic and exciting events. You read this passage and you think, well, where are the legions of screaming demons which are being driven out of their convulsing victims? They're not here, are they? Where are the paralyzed men who are walking? Well, they're not here. Where are the howling winds and the sheets of rain and the boiling waters being brought to calm by Jesus' word? Well, they're not here. Where is the sense of amazement following this miracle? In the healing of the deaf man, in chapter 7, verse 37, people are astonished beyond measure, it says in that verse. But not here with this feeding miracle. There's no astonishment here. It's just a meal. And it's not a very impressive meal at that. It's just bread and fish, possibly just the local sardines, the staples of the local Galilean diet. I mean, this is the man who apparently turned water into wine. Could he not at least turn that little bit of fish into a joint of succulent roast lamb? Could he not turn that little bit of bread into a nice slice of chocolate cake? He might be the great physician, but he's hardly a great chef, and bread and fish is hardly a banquet. And then there's the performance of the miracle itself. There's no dramatic announcement from Jesus that we've seen on other occasions. There's no lightning in the sky. There's no appearance of angels. He just does what everyone else does at supper time. He gives thanks for the food. And then he hands it out. And yes, it divides among these thousands of people. But even then, it's not as if the bread suddenly grows up into some huge mountain and everyone then clambers over to get a piece of this bread. No, it's almost as if Mark doesn't even notice when the miracle happens. It's as if the disciples don't really know at what point it occurred. They just shared the bread. That's all that happens. That's all that's recorded. Indeed, the fact that the disciples can ask the question in verse 4, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place, suggests that they have already forgotten the feeding of the 5,000. Presumably that was so unimpressive, so undramatic, they've actually forgotten about it. And so I'm saying then that Jesus, in performing this miracle, and Mark, in recording this miracle, are to some extent presenting it as nothing particularly extraordinary. It's just an ordinary meal. And if you were one of those 4,000 people sitting there, it's possible, I think, that amongst all of the hustle and bustle and the chit-chat and the eating, you might not have even noticed that any miracle took place at all. That's how apparently unimpressive it is. But I said unimpressive and yet substantial. And there is true substance, isn't there, in this miracle. Jesus is miraculously feeding and sustaining people who would have otherwise fainted on their way back home in verse 3. Like the feeding of the 5,000, the people in the 4,000 are going away in verse 8 satisfied. They are having a substantial meal. Yes, it's unimpressive, but it is substantial. And I would just put it to you now that this is what true biblical religion always looks like. Because the unimpressive way in which Jesus sustains these people with bread and fish is in keeping with, is just like, the unimpressive way in which he sustains and feeds you and I here today. His care for their stomachs is in keeping with his care for our hearts and souls. And that parallel, which I'm talking about, the physical bread and his care for his people, that's a parallel which has been spelled out several times already, isn't it, in this book. Remember, we don't have to turn there now, but remember how in the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus' physical feeding goes alongside his teaching feeding. There is a picture, that bread is a picture of his teaching. Or remember how in chapter 6, verse 51, we are told that the disciples failed to understand the loaves. What did they fail to understand? Well, I think they failed to understand that the loaves represented Jesus' total care for his people. And then remember in chapter 7 how we saw how Jesus spoke to the Gentile woman of the children's bread, not referring to literal bread, but referring to his broader ministry, his provision for Israel. You see, bread in Mark's gospel is a picture of one's religious diet, in this case, coming from the hands of Jesus Christ. And so then, the unimpressive yet substantial way in which Jesus sustains these people is in keeping with the unimpressive yet substantial way in which he sustains your daily Christian life today. Bear this in mind. If you're worrying that your Christian life is a bit unimpressive and needs a bit of a booster, needs to have something else to make it a bit more exciting, take note of this fact. Jesus is feeding you. He feeds you every time you meet together in this place and hear his word preached. He is feeding you, and he gives you all you will ever need to be sustained in that way. You think, well, I'm just an ordinary person. I don't have any dramatic life story. I don't have any heavenly visions. I don't do great acts of virtue or self-sacrifice. I frequently feel weak and powerless. I'm just a very ordinary person. Again, I say to you, Jesus is feeding you. He is sustaining you. He is giving you everything you need. You say, well, I just pray to my God. I just read his word. I just come here and worship and listen to the Bible being read out and preached. And I eat the bread and the wine when it comes round, and I speak to my Christian friends. But all of that happens just amongst a very ordinary, normal ups and downs of regular life. And yet that is what true biblical substantial religion looks like. Through all of those ordinary features of your life, you are being fed, you are being filled, you are being sustained. You haven't fainted yet, and the reason you haven't is because Jesus is feeding you. Just because you haven't spotted the miracle amongst all of the humdrum, the unimpressive, normal life, it doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. It has happened, and your very presence here this evening is proof of that fact. And so I say to you again, appreciate the substance of your ordinary daily bread. It's a miraculous gift from the hands of Jesus Christ. And if that doesn't satisfy you, I would caution you at this point. If you are still thinking, but my daily Christian life could do with something a bit more exciting, it could do with a few more miracles, something more impressive. Isn't it time for a bit of zest, a bit of spice? If you're thinking that this evening, then I would say to you, beware of religion number two. Beware of religion number two. That's the second form of religion I want to identify in this passage. False religion. Apparently impressive and yet airy. Apparently impressive yet airy. You see, in verse 11, these Pharisees arrive on the scene. And these Pharisees are men who want to be impressed. In verse 11, they're seeking a sign from heaven. Now, these men have seen a lot of Jesus' power already, haven't they? They've admitted back in chapter 3 that Jesus can cast out demons. The scribes have witnessed the healing of a lame man in chapter 2. The Pharisees saw the healing of the man with the shriveled hand. So what are these Pharisees after now? Well, presumably they want a sign from heaven which exceeds all of that. Something impressive, something colourful, something showy. You see, for them, proper religion must be able to impress. It must be impressive. After all, isn't that what the Pharisees were all about? See, if Jesus' ministry was characterized by simple preaching, theirs was a religion of ceremony, of elaborate rules and rituals, of heavy legal training. Jesus says, they do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honor at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others. See, theirs was a religion which was designed to impress. They might not be able to wow you with a miracle, but they could wow you with other things. They could wow you with their displays of piety, contorting their faces when they were fasting, or praying long, impressive prayers. This was surely an attempt to capture the prowess, the impressiveness, the grandiosity that they thought true religion deserved. But what was to be gained in all of that impressive-looking religion? Well, not much more than a lot of hot air. Look at verse 15. And he cautioned them, it's Jesus, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. What does Jesus mean by leaven? Well, I can't be fully sure about this, but when Jesus speaks of leaven, I can't help but see one more reference to bread in amongst so many of the references to bread that we've already seen this evening. Bread being a picture of one's religious diet. And so I think Jesus' point may well be something like this. Jesus is saying, look, the bread, the religion that I offer you looks flat and meagre and limited, and at first glance there are only a few little rolls to feed so many mouths. It's so unimpressive. And yet, in spite of how unimpressive it looks, it is satisfying. It is infinitely plentiful. My food is miracle food, and under my care you will be sustained forever. The bread, the religious diet of Jesus, that's what it is. It's substantial. But what about these Pharisees? What about Herod? Well, Jesus is saying here, I think, these men will offer you a bread, a religion which is filled with leaven. It doesn't look meagre, it doesn't look small, it looks big and puffed up, it looks spongy and springy, it has a good crust to it, it offers much, it's full of promise. Compared to what Jesus offers, their bread looks very impressive, very filling. The Pharisees will wow you with their long robes and their laws and their piety, and you'll look at that and you'll think, surely we need a bit of that in our religion. Or Herod and Herod's palace, they'll wow you with their banquets that we considered a number of weeks ago, their power, their tantalizing, lively lifestyles. And you look at that and you think, surely our religion needs a little bit more of that. You see, these men, they offer you much to your appetites, but at the end of the day, it is not substantial because it is just leaven. It is just air. It's puffiness. It's not nutrition. It's inflation. It's like a McDonald's hamburger you see in the picture, don't you? And it just looks so big and fresh and plump and appetizing. But that's not what arrives in your plate. That's not what arrives in your tray in the restaurant. And the point is then, whatever these men might promise, the only thing their religion has to offer, which Jesus' religion does not, is a bit of deceptive air. It's a gaseous, it's an airy sort of religion. And at the end of the day, it doesn't sustain you. It doesn't satisfy you because it has no substance. I said it's a bit of deceptive air. Well, I think religion too, as I'm calling it, is designed to deceive. It's designed with that intent. Look at verse 11 again, these Pharisees. When it says the Pharisees came, the Greek expresses it slightly differently. It says they came out. It almost has a military feel to it. Then they argue with him in that verse. That is, they oppose him. And then it says they are seeking from him. But that's not a sort of neutral expression, seeking from him. It's a word which in this gospel really is used to almost to try to control him. That's what it's saying. And then you get to that word test. They're testing him. Well, that the last time we heard that word test was in the devil's testing of Jesus in the wilderness. And so I would argue, at the very least, that religion too has a strong flavour of the devil and his strong military opposition to it. That clash of spiritual forces we witnessed in the wilderness back at the beginning of this book. After all, it was the devil who first provoked Jesus to doubt God's sustaining power, who tested him to do something a bit more impressive, to turn the rocks into bread, rather than trust in the invisible, sustaining compassion of his Father. So I would say to you then, beware of this leaven, whatever it might be in your life. It might be a religion of colour and wonder, maybe a religious group who offers you something a bit more than ordinary Christianity. They offer you impressive miracles, or they offer you amazing stories and anecdotes, encounters with angels, that sort of thing. Or it might be a religion which offers you a more stringent moral code, a stricter set of rules, which you think, that's just a more serious religion, that's the kind of thing I need. Or it might be nothing like that. It might be a religion of fame and recognition, this Herodian kind of religion, which dazzles you with its promises of license and liberty and being able to do whatever you please. Whatever it might be, I'm saying to you, don't be deceived by it. It is the religion of the world and the devil. It might look impressive, it might offer you much, it might be full of promise, it might look a cut above ordinary Christianity. Don't be deceived. It is airy. It's devised by the least trustworthy of all creatures, the devil himself. No, instead, embrace simple, unimpressive, yet substantial Christianity, the real food of Jesus Christ. So that is those two religions. But having observed these two religions, I now just want to consider the role of the disciples in all of this. Where do the disciples sit? Where do they stand with regard to Jesus and the Pharisees and these two religions? Well, as we were reading verses 11 to 13, this encounter with the Pharisees, part of us still might be thinking something like, well, if only these Pharisees had seen what just took place, if only they had witnessed this feeding of the 4,000, then they would have been persuaded. If only they'd seen and heard what these disciples had seen and heard, this feeding of the 4,000. But here's the point. The disciples, at one level, may have seen and heard this feeding miracle. But at another level, they very much hadn't seen and heard this miracle. You see, whatever they'd seen and heard, it wasn't enough to stop them fretting about their own lack of bread in the boat in verse 16. There they are, they only have one loaf and they're worried about it. And is it not then totally incredible that of all the things to be worried about right now, the very thing they would be worried about is a lack of bread, of not being filled by the bread? I mean, back in chapter 6, you could argue that it was reasonable for them to be worried about how Jesus would feed 5,000 men. They hadn't seen a feeding miracle like that before. When we get to chapter 8, however, and they're worrying about how these 4,000 people would be fed by Jesus, clearly that's no longer a reasonable kind of worry. They had seen that miracle before. I mean, if you read that account and you were thinking to yourself, well, this isn't really very realistic. Why would they have worried about the feeding of the 4,000 if they'd just seen the feeding of the 5,000? Well, that's precisely what you're supposed to think. They haven't been paying attention. But here now in verse 16, chapter 8, 16, having now witnessed not one but two feeding miracles, for them to be still worried about how 12 men would be fed with one loaf by Jesus, well, that wasn't at all reasonable. They are now totally without excuse. This was nothing less than a refusal to see Jesus for who he truly was, the great shepherd of the sheep. And so I say again, these disciples may have at one level seen and heard these miracles, but at another level, they very much hadn't seen and heard these miracles. Hence Jesus' questioning in verses 17 to 21. Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves of the 5,000? How many baskets full of pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? He's saying, don't you yet see who I am? Don't you see what I'm all about? Are you still so small scale, so limited in your thinking? Did my miracle just pass you by? Didn't you see what happened? Was it so unimpressive to you that you failed to even notice what was happening? You failed to even stop and pause and notice that there were more leftovers than there were bread and fish in the first place. See, the disciples did not see and hear. Having eyes, they did not see, and ears, they did not hear. You speak to many people, and it seems like the feeding of the 5,000 is the one miracle of Jesus they actually remember. Everything else sort of fades into the background. That's the one thing they know. He fed 5,000 people. But for these disciples, it's as if that's the one miracle they've forgotten. They can't remember these miracles taking place. And why was that? Why had they failed to properly take this in? Well, probably, I think, because it had gotten lost amongst all of the wonderful, impressive, colourful drama of their new lives. All these impressive healings that they'd witnessed, the thoughts of this coming kingdom of God, with all of that filling their heads, it was easy to miss something as ordinary as bread and fish. A few ordinary people had been fed in a very ordinary way, and the disciples were more concerned about their own ambitions, their own impressive prospects, that they really noticed little more than that. And that's why I think Jesus warns them away from this leaven, away from this impressive-looking religion. Why was that necessary? Well, surely because he knew how easily their hearts could be taken in by that kind of thing. In fact, in this gospel, we're reaching a bit of a sort of halfway point in Mark's gospel. And the next stage of this gospel is going to be characterized by that kind of misunderstanding from the disciples. For a long time, the disciples are going to be idolizing earthly status. They will argue among themselves about who's the greatest. They will argue about who will sit at the right and the left of Jesus' throne. For some time, there will be still far too much of the Pharisee in these disciples. And this then is why I asked the question, where do the disciples fit into all this? What religion did they belong to after all? In fact, I think that's Jesus' question in verses 14 to 21. Among that heavy shelling of questions you get in those verses, the real question underlying all of that is, are you disciples really that different from the Pharisees? The Pharisees aren't the only ones filled with puffed up worldly concerns. The Pharisees aren't the only ones who are unable to trust me with something as simple as this. The Pharisees aren't the only ones with eyes that don't see and ears that don't hear. And you know, verses 11 to 12 are very much the end of the line for the Pharisees. Jesus dismisses them in strong terms and then he leaves them on the other side of the lake. But what about the disciples? Are they any different? Is it the end of the line for them as well? And what about ourselves? What about our blindness and deafness to Jesus? What about our worldly distractions? Aren't we like these disciples, so puffed up with self and worldly aspirations and so far away from our shepherd Jesus that it only takes one little hiccup and suddenly we're fretting and worrying and feeling very much alone and away from him again? Must it be the end of the line for us as well? That might be a serious challenge for you this evening. It was for these disciples. Whose side are you on? Whose religion are you following? We need to wake up and we need to heed that call. We need that rousing. We need to check ourselves and ask, is there still a Pharisee lurking in us this evening? And yet, in spite of that, there remains, even still, a great hope in this passage. There's a great hope in this passage. And here is why. It's not the end of the line for the disciples, because there is, in the background, another miracle taking place in this passage. And it's a miracle which isn't just taking place in this passage, but it's taking place throughout the whole book of Mark. And it's a miracle which, on the one hand, is so quiet and so apparently unimpressive, you will hardly notice it's taken place until you get to the end of the book of Mark. In fact, you'll hardly notice it before you're in the book of Acts. And yet, at the same time, it is a miracle, and it's a very dramatic miracle, properly considered at that. And the miracle that I'm talking about, and I want to discuss to end this evening, is what I'm calling the healing of the disciples. The healing of the disciples. What do I mean by that? Well, I want to close by considering the two parts of the passage we haven't yet looked at. The beginning of our passage, verses chapter 7, verse 31 to 37, and the end of our passage, chapter 8, verses 22 to 26. You see, here's the point I'm coming to. I don't think it's a coincidence that Jesus asks that question, having eyes do you not yet see, and having ears do you not yet hear. I don't think it's a coincidence that that question is surrounded by the healings of a man who is blind in the eyes and a man who is deaf in the ears. Jesus' words there are referring backwards and forwards to those two miracles. And this is my contention then, that while these disciples are still in many places blind and deaf, Jesus, in this very passage, is revealing himself as the one who opens ears and opens eyes. He is healing these disciples. And indeed, he is healing you this evening in the same way that he heals the deaf man in chapter 7, 31 to 37, and the blind man in 8, 22 to 26. Just notice briefly three things, three common features of these healings. Firstly, they're quiet healings, aren't they? Their purpose is not public display. In chapter 8, verse 23, Jesus takes the blind man out of the village and warns him from going back into the village in verse 26. Likewise, the deaf man is dealt with privately, it says in chapter 7, 33, and he's charged not to tell anyone in verse 36. You see, both of these healings have a quiet, personal, almost disguised quality to them. They're quiet healings. Secondly, they're crude healings. They're crude healings. In both cases, the people come to Jesus begging that Jesus will lay his hands on these men. Now, at other times, it's been very clear that it hasn't been necessary for him to lay his hands on people. He can heal people with a mere command. That's what he did with the daughter of the Gentile woman in the previous passage. He healed her from a distance. But here, you see, he actually does something which is more awkward and more crude and more clumsy than the people asked in the first place. He doesn't lay his hands on them, he spits on them. Don't be tempted to skip over that awkward detail or refuse to imagine it. No, the Son of God, our dignified Saviour who calms the storm with a word, decides to heal these men by gathering saliva in his mouth and then applying it to their ears and their eyes and their tongue, to the bodily sensing organs of these people. It's not very elegant. It's a very crude healing. So they're quiet healings, they're crude healings, and then thirdly, they're gradual healings. Or at least that the blind man is a gradual healing. The blind man, you know, visions of rapture don't burst on his sight. No, rather he goes from a total blindness to partial blindness to being able to see clearly. He goes from not being able to read any of the letters on the optician's chart to reading half of the letters, sort of halfway up, to reading the full chart. It's a gradual healing. The people look like walking trees, he says, partway through. And I think we can say the same thing for the healing of the perception of these disciples. Their personal healing happens quietly and privately, and it's often helped along with personal conversations with Jesus. Their healing is crude, and it's awkward, and it's sloppy and inelegant, and it often involves unpleasantness. It doesn't have dignity to it. It's at times embarrassing for them. They're rebuked. They feel ashamed. It's awkward. And then it takes time, doesn't it? It's not immediate. Their eyes and their ears are opened gradually. And yet, for all its quietness, for all its crudeness, and for all its slowness, the fact of the matter is, it is a miracle that men as dumb as these disciples would go on to be the teachers, the illuminators of the whole world, has to be a miracle. That the most insightful theologian who has ever lived since these men is forced to rely on the words of a man so dumb as Simon Peter indicates that a colossal miracle took place in that man's life. His eyes were opened, his tongue was loosened, his ears were opened. And that is a miracle that we all share in this evening. If you are a Christian this evening who is doubting the genuineness of your faith and you're worried that Jesus might desert you and leave you with those Pharisees on the other side of the lake, let me remind you once more this evening, a miracle is taking place in your life. And it's not just a feeding, sustaining miracle, it is a healing miracle. Grasp that. With every day that passes, you are being transported, like these disciples, out of darkness and into light. You're being transported out of silence and into a world filled with the textures of music and sound, out of senselessness and into sense, out of closure and into openness. However unimpressive life might feel, that miracle is taking place in your life. Just look at these two miracles on either side of this account. Just while we say on one level they're quiet, they're crude, they're gradual, nevertheless, there is no getting away from the fact that they are awesome miracles of God. Jesus looks up to heaven in verse 34. This is the best kind of heavenly wonder he's about to display, far better than anything a Pharisee could have asked for. These are great liberations, however clumsy they might be. The ears aren't simply improved in chapter 7, verse 35. They are opened. The eyes are not simply improved in chapter 8, verse 25. They are opened. The speech impediment of the deaf man is not simply improved. His tongue is released. That is, it's cut from its chain. This is a great liberation. As if those eyes had been sort of sealed over, encrusted over, and now they're broken out and they're filled with light. As if those ears had been like scrunched up little buds and now they're opened like flowers and being filled with sound. There's a great power in these miracles. And let me just close by saying that if you are a follower of Jesus this evening, put yourself into these miracles. Yes, you struggle. Yes, progress is slow and painful. Yes, comprehension is limited and unfolds gradually. Your ability to pay attention to services wavers. You get distracted by personal ambition. Yes, that's all true. But in the mistiness and the messiness of this strange life, there is a miraculous healing going on. Bit by bit, Jesus Christ, through the power of his Spirit, is working in you a miracle. He is healing your eyes, he is opening your ears, and he's helping you to perceive him in all of his beauty and all of his goodness. And he's loosing your tongue and helping you to speak forth of the wonders of his name. We must pray for more of that healing. We must crave for that healing. This blind man, this deaf man, they could have wanted nothing more for those senses to be restored. That must be our desire too. We should beg Jesus to open us, to restore us, and to fill our feeble perceptions with all of his goodness and all of his beauty. Let's pray for that this evening. And Jesus, as the one who hears and answers prayers and delights to give us what we desire, this is precisely what he desires for us to desire. That our whole perception will be filled with him, that we would love him, that we would sing his praises. Amen.